Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and tis the season for music lovers. The Eastern Music Festival in Greensboro, App State's and Appalachian Summer Festival, the list of well-known live music listening opportunities just goes on and on each summer in the Triad. But what about the Wayne C. Henderson Music Festival and Guitar Competition in Heavenly Grayson Highland State Park? Roseanne Cash will be there. Will you? Or how about the first annual Siren Mountain Jam in Boone with Joan Osborne, Toshi Reagan, and Michelle Indeggio-Cello? Yes, I did just say Michelle Indeggio-Cello, and yes, she is here to share. Today in the show, we'll preview both festivals with Wayne Henderson and his pal Herb Key live in Studio A. But first, we'll step down from the mountains for a conversation with Winston-Salem pop rock band Estrangers. They've got a new album out. That's right, album. Remember those shiny vinyl things that spun? Our technical producer, Jews and Catholics frontman Eddie Garcia, chats it up with the band next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Winston-Salem-based band Estrangers has just recorded a new album, but they did it old school, to analog tape with Ryan Pritz at El Guapo Recorders on the south side of Winston. Season of 1,000 Colors will be released tonight, Friday, June 14th, at the Garage in Winston-Salem. It's a 9 o'clock start, and Estrangers will be joined by Human Eyes and Body Games. Tickets are just $7, and you'll find links to more information on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. In the meantime, Triad Arts Weekend's own technical producer and guitarist, vocalist, songwriter Eddie Garcia recently caught up with Estrangers vocalist and guitarist Philip Pledger and drummer Drew Braden. Eddie sat down to talk shop with the boys, and you get to be a fly on the wall.
So from what I understand, you guys recorded on 2-inch analog tape. Mm-hmm. And for those out there that might not know, that isn't the norm anymore. Now, thanks to all the digital technology and whatnot, most people just sort of record into a computer, record into a hard drive. So why did you go back in time?
In a lot of ways, it kind of simplifies the process, which is cool. Forces you to make some decisions about what you like about your songs and choose between those and the ideas that you're like, oh, yeah, maybe I want to add, like, 12 more guitar tracks, you know, and then we just like mix them together. It's like that sometimes works, but a lot of the time it doesn't. But you know, also it just sounds really good. Like it sounds really warm and full without you having to spend a bunch of time fixing it up or whatever.
Have you recorded in an analog environment before?
We did our first EP there as well. That was on 8-track, so that really forced the issue as far as choosing what we were going to have on the song and what we had to cut. Yeah, I think analog's fun.
Well, having listened to the record, it does have a very big and lush sound. Now, surely I know a lot of that was due to the songs and how the songs were written, but talk to me about the recording process and maybe what your preconceptions were going in about what you wanted the record to sound like, and then where it ultimately wound up, and maybe how the recording process played into that.
Looking back, I'm amazed that it happened, just because there are so many points at which it could have fallen apart. Back in December, when we were trying to figure out exactly what we were going to do, our plan was to record with Ryan onto tape. It's this awesome studio on the south side of Winston-Salem. Our plan was to record there, but then bounce it all to digital tracks and then mix it ourselves and add keyboards and vocals. And then after that, get it digitally mastered. From there, the music is changing hands several times. And going into it, I was having nightmares about, you know, spending a bunch of money on a product that we were not going to be happy with. But Ryan, he's like the best kept secret of the Southeast.
Tell me a little more about the studio.
His name's Ryan Pritz. His studio is called El Guapo, which I think means the most handsome or something. Handsome one. Oh, handsome one.
Which is appropriate for
very
him.
Appropriate. He's quite a man. He's one of those guys that could tear apart your car and then build it back up from scratch. So yeah, we recorded most of the instruments, all the basic instruments with Ryan on the tape. And then after that, we just took all the tracks and basically recorded the vocals and keyboards at our keyboardist's house. His name's David Todd, and I'm pretty sure his wife is a saint for allowing us to just take over his living room for like a month.
Wow.
But yeah, he did a great job, and it sounds, you know, hopefully exactly what you were saying, you know, lush and like a good pop album should sound.
The ambient sound of the background vocals, like say on a track like Cape Fear, which is after the opening instrumental track, the inspiration for having that kind of background vocals, they're like these phantom ghost background vocals. Was that always the idea, or was that, did this come out in the studio?
The first part of the song that you're talking about was the first thing that was written for that, and that basically was just a result of me being on like a huge Beach Boys kick. Of course, they were doing like these extremely elaborate harmonies and things. That was probably just me trying to channel 10% of that energy. It's supposed to sound big and ethereal in some kind of way, like mysterious, but also really pretty.
So how does that translate live? Is it difficult to recreate those types of flourishes, background vocals and whatnot live? And do you try to do it, or are you consider the live show, it's a separate beast?
Well, Drew,
it's
here.
It's a great question.
It's a great question. Drew has brought this up several times. Live is a little bit of a different animal. I think overall, the vibe of the band is very much in tune with the records, as far as we use a lot of like bigger sounding reverbs on the guitars and keyboards and things. And I try to put a reverb on the vocals as well, depending on who's running sound or whatever. We're actually going to start having our keyboardist do some background vocals, I think. We haven't gotten around to it yet.
Okay.
I give him a hard time about some of the the background vocals that aren't present, because like that one in particular, I think adds a lot to it. So I just want to pressure him to try to do it.
Band pressure.
Have they put a microphone in front of you?
They haven't.
And do a little Phil Collins?
Yeah, I've thought about it.
Drew, how long have you been with the Strangers?
I joined the band right as they were recording the new album.
Literally.
Yeah, I hung out on the couch and played a little tambourine. But I've been performing with them since March, I believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what was it like coming in, you know, after this record had been made and, you know, learning all these songs, and did you feel any pressure?
Only pressure in that I had been a fan of the band before. I knew the first album songs just from having listened to it a bunch. But I wanted to, of course, bring it. There was a bit of a rush. We had about a month for me to learn the first set, but it really wasn't that stressful. It went pretty smoothly, I think.
It's because you're a pro.
Well, I try.
All right, so let's go back and talk about the beginnings of A Strangers, Philip. When did it start? How did it start?
It started about a little over two years ago. I was playing guitar in another band for a while, and that was great just to be able to focus on guitar. But then I started to write more songs, not just for the guitar, but with vocals as well. I was also in a weird place personally, you know, personal problems. Issues
with the ladies?
Maybe.
What other kind of problems are there?
You don't have to go into any details, but feel free.
No, it's fine. I won't. It's cool. I'm in a much better place. But yeah, so, you know, I was writing songs, and there was another band that was breaking up at the time, and a couple of those guys were wanting to start a new band. And so Mike Wallace, who plays guitar with us now, joined the band at that point, and there are a couple other guys that don't play in A Strangers anymore. but they joined as well, and we kind of took it from there, and we recorded the first EP within the first 6 months of us existing, so it was very much a quick documentation of what we had at the moment. The band started with the recordings, and then since then we've evolved and grown.
And you've had a few lineup changes too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Due to circumstance, creative wants, desires, or?
There's a number of things. Thinking back, it's pretty cool to see. Actually, I mean, I feel privileged to like play with the people that I've played with. Pat Sheehan has a new band. He used to be our drummer, and he's now in a new band with his sister, and they play really awesome, like, psychedelic surf beach music. So I'm glad he's doing that. And original bass player Trevor, he lives in Durham now, but he plays in a band called Drag Sounds that's really awesome too. And Jody Burns used to sing and play keyboards in the band, and she has her own band now, and she also is a professional opera singer, which also plays into it as well. So I'm more just, you know, thankful to have great people and great musicians to play with, and looking back, it's pretty cool.
For the record, the record is entitled Season of 1,000 Colors.
Season of 1,000 Colors.
Of 1,000. Why would I say 1,000?
Well, I mean, because, you know, to be fair, you're right. It actually does say 1,000.
It does. It's a very colorful looking record,
mm-hmm.
The cover, and the vinyl itself. The vinyl itself, you're releasing this record on vinyl
mm-hmm.
in 2013. Why are you doing that?
I don't know. Why are we doing that, Drew?
I just had some money I wanted to spend on something.
Yeah. No, I feel like, you know, it's easy to put things online, and that's what we've done until now. We've never had any kind of recording put on any kind of physical medium. But then you reach a point where you're investing all this time and energy into your music, and I feel like vinyl is just like this very tangible extension of that.
It is more of an experience, because I'll listen to an album that I have on iTunes and I have it on vinyl while I get annoyed having to go and flip it every 15 minutes. I get to look at the art, feel it in my hands when I'm putting it on, and the sound is kind of smoother.
Warmer.
Yeah, cohesive is the word I like to keep using when I try to sell these after shows.
Yeah, I think it's a big commitment. So if you see a band that's putting something on vinyl, they probably didn't just make it in their basement and decide to press it to vinyl, because that's a pretty big process. It takes 2 months minimum to do it.
Let's talk about the way this vinyl looks, because the cover is really striking, and the vinyl, and you know, some of our listeners might not know, but records don't just come in black,
right?
They come in different colors these days. We're gonna post a picture on our website and a link to where people can take a good look at it. But why don't you describe the look of this package for listeners?
Well, we really wanted it to match the sound of the record, and I think it's very much a summer pop album. And so in that way, we wanted the packaging to represent that. The vinyl itself is transparent blue, but it's got this like orange cloud in the middle of it too. So depending on the light, you know, if you hold up to the light, it's very light blue, but it's pretty cool. We had a local Winston artist, Andrew Fansler, do our album cover. And it's actually like the third thing he's done with us. And he's one of our favorite artists around, and I think his aesthetic is just a really nice touch for the record.
Shows coming up?
Yeah, we're playing actually tonight, Friday, June 14th. Planet of the Garage is technically going to be our record release party because our record came out this week. And we're playing with two great bands from the Triangle area. It's an electronic band called Body Games and like an 80s pop band called The Human Eyes.
So getting back to the record, the overall feel of the record, it is it's got a watery, sunny type of feel, but like with this, you know, there's an air of melancholy over the whole thing. It's almost like kind of a sunny outlook on maybe some disappointing experiences. Is that an accurate representation of the record?
Yeah, I mean, we were initially going to call it Summer of a Thousand Colors, but I think Season leaves it a little bit more open. Summer can imply a certain type of positive vibe, which is certainly true, but you know, even summertime there are nights that are, you know, just like oppressively humid and dark.
And Season leaves it more open. It's like the whole album feels like a passing of a period of time in someone's life, so I think it works on that level too.
Exactly. And you know, just like anything else in life, nothing is completely wonderful or flawless, and so it is an upbeat record, but there is some emotional complexity to it as well.
Got some good lines on this record, too. One standout is on the song Monarchs. I'd kill for love, but I'd die for rock and roll. Is that true?
That song is about a friend of ours who's one of my musical heroes. It's kind of just like an homage to him, trying to like channel his energy for the song. But then again, you have to wonder how close you are yourself to the character that you're trying to channel, both musically and also on a personal level.
But I think the answer is yes.
Throughout the record, you have these instrumental passages. You bookend the record instrumentally, and then you work some throughout. There's one really cool one in particular called Moonraker. It's got this really kind of like 60s spy riff thing happening.
I wanted to make an album in the truest sense. I didn't want it to be like, here's a song, all right, song's over, next song, all right, this song is over, here's the next song. I want it to be more of a blended experience to where it's kind of a wave that washes over you, and when you listen to it in sequence, it's more affecting than if you're putting the album on shuffle, so.
It helps tell the narrated story, too.
Yeah.
Jews and Catholics frontman and Triad Arts Weekend technical producer Eddie Garcia took the reins on that interview. Nice job, Eddie. He spoke with the Strangers vocalist and guitarist Philip Pledger and drummer Drew Braden about their new album, not to be confused with CD, y'all. It's titled Season of 1,000 Colors, and you'll find links to more information about the new release, upcoming Strangers concerts, and more at WFDD.org. Just click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can be the first to get your hands on a copy hot off the press before, during, and after hearing the album live at The Garage in Winston-Salem. The Estrangers album release party kicks off at 9 o'clock tonight, Friday, June 14th, and they'll be joined by Human Eyes and Body Games. Tickets for all the fun, just $7. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I must say, we've got quite a show for you today. Well, that is, if you happen to like platinum recording artists Michelle and Agiocello and Nina Simone, or how about National Heritage Award-winning guitarist Wayne Henderson live in Studio A? Yep, Wayne will be right here with his pal, guitarist and bassist Herb Key, picking and grinning like you won't believe. Outstanding artists talking up two amazing music festivals going on this month right here in our own backyard, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We've got Wayne Henderson and Herb Key waiting in the wings down in Studio A, and boy, it's going to be good. But in the meantime, well, quite frankly, are y'all ready for this?
You say that's your boyfriend, you say I'm out of line. Funny, he said I could call him up anytime.
Summertime and the living is easy, especially if you're an arts lover in the Triad. So many music festivals, so little time, and one of the newest can be found in the beautiful High Country. The Siren Mountain Jam invites everyone to celebrate music and art created by women. The two-day festival kicks off on the first day of summer, Friday, June 21st, in the High Country Fairgrounds in Boone. Siren Mountain Jam brings together some of the best women musicians and female-fronted bands, world-class artists, and nonprofit women's organizations for a weekend of fun, with vegetarian and non-vegetarian food options, on-site camping, and nearby hotel accommodations. There'll be 15 bands in all, concluding Saturday night from 9:30 to 11 with platinum recording artist, singer-songwriter Joan Osborne. Friday's headliner is American singer-songwriter, rapper, bassist, vocalist, and multiple Grammy-nominated artist Michelle Andeggio-Cello. When I first heard Michelle's debut album, Plantation Lullabies, back in 1993, I thought to myself, who is this powerful singer and how did she get bass master Marcus Miller to play on her first record? Little did I know then that the bass player was Michelle, and she would go on to become the first female bass player to appear on the cover of Bass Player magazine. Her original music combines great songwriting, powerful vocals, and virtuosic bass playing, and it showcases her mastery of virtually all styles of music. Her most recent release is For a Sovereign Soul, a dedication to Nina Simone. It's Michelle's 10th record. She spoke with me by cell phone from her home in New York.
I've been looking back in terms of, like, the blues, like, even pre-blues and African music with that similar sort of harmonic structure. And I find myself trying to re-envision those chord changes, the blues as a chord progression. So lately I've been just trying to find new ways to re-harmonize those voicings. And so that's kind of where my mind is. And I've been really into modern classical music and sort of Baroque music, music with really simple instrumentation. That's kind of where my mind is now.
Where's the attraction for you when you're talking about, you know, expanding your conception of the blues, or in this case, your approach to that?
Well, I used to run away from it. I mean, my father, I felt a bit oppressed as a child. Like, my father, like, really wanted me to play the blues, and it was just something I sort of ran away from. So I'm looking at it just so I can have a better relationship with it, and I get great enjoyment out of a lot of blues music I've been hearing, revisiting. So what I most admire about it is that you can walk in a room full of musicians, and it allows you to interact without even having a conversation. It allows you to play something that you may not all know the melody or the lyrics to. It just immediately creates a bridge between everyone, every musician in the room. And so that's why I'm trying to revisit it, so I can work out some different ways of creating improvisational spaces with people. But we have this structured foundation that I've sort of deconstructed, but that will bring us together.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? How do I make it?
No, that makes perfect sense. You walk
nothing in. New. Yeah, I mean, people do it all the time, but I just want to try to see what I can bring to the table with it.
Yeah.
People start to think it's different either by lyrical content, melodic content, or instrumentation. So those are the things I'm concentrating on as well. Good.
Yeah. I was interested in going down the list of some influences. Right off the bat, it was Sting and Stevie Wonder as a couple of big influences on your music making. Was it mostly their songwriting, their playing, their singing? Which aspect grabs you?
you hit it on the head. I mean, Stevie Wonder transcends, you know, just being a musician. He's really tapped into something else. But I love the fact that he's melodic. He deals with harmony, and his bass lines are some of the most incredible, fluid, groovy things I've ever heard. And of course, I'm drawn to them. I want to be. I'm a bass player who sings. So Stevie Wonder and Sting were kind of, and Prince were my the people I wish could mentor me when I was a kid, but I just did it through listening to their records.
Yeah,
and I just enjoy their ability to bring all those aspects together. So that's why I have such great admiration for them.
And going back all the way to the Baroque, which is interesting, and what's fascinating you these days? And is there a composer from that period that you're gravitating toward and kind of revisiting?
Probably the German composers are my favorite. I'd have to say Johann Georg Poseidel. He's from Dresden. The only thing I love about the modernity of of life these days is just all the stuff I'm able to find online. So I can't really say I have a favorite. I'm still in the studying stages, trying to understand the form and familiarize myself with all the different styles in Europe and somehow embody that within myself. The thing I wanted to be most as a child was not a bass player. I just wanted to be a songwriter. And so that's how I kind of research music, is just to understand its form. Because if I can learn it myself, then I can recreate it, but also pass it through my filter with my creativity and hopefully come up with something that is of interest, you know, and feels of the now.
What do you enjoy most about just that act, that creating the music, songwriting?
As a writer, I just try to stay burning with a desire to express myself. And then as just being a curious person, I find myself wanting to understand all the forms so that when I come across people, I'm able to communicate with them. Because that's what keeps, in my limited opinion, the artist working and growing, and so that you're not like a generational artist or a one-hit wonder. I just try to stay curious about all the music that exists, so that I can move through those worlds and meet different people and as I age, have something to offer as a teacher, you know, or as a mentor.
Being observant. I was talking to a poet recently about that aspect of just paying attention in life.
Yeah.
Black is a color of my true love's hair.
I wanted to thank you for introducing me to, reintroducing you to the music of Nina Simone, and I know that's been a big part of your performance recently. What are some of the things about her approach to music and music making that grab your imagination?
Her classical background, she was born in a time where education was, I mean, one of the most important things that one could hope to have, so her intelligence. I also appreciate that she could take other people's songs, rearrange them, and make them her own. And even though she didn't consider herself a jazz musician, she could improvise as a player, as an arranger, and just as a human being in general in life. And also that it's not a pretty story. You know, her public life seemed to sometimes overshadow her capabilities as an artist. And yeah, I just think she's an interesting person. And I think the only reason why I have a career is that it was women like her who paved the way that someone like me could exist.
Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Well, I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
American singer, songwriter, rapper, bassist, vocalist, and multiple Grammy-nominated artist Michelle Andeggio-Cello. Michelle was the first woman to be featured on the cover of Bass Player magazine. She's an apt headliner indeed for an entire festival that celebrates music and art created by women. The Siren Mountain Jam kicks off on the first day of summer, Friday, June 21st at 11 a.m. in the High Country Fairgrounds in Boone. Michelle's performance will begin Friday night at 9:30. And on Saturday night at 9:30, it'll be singer-songwriter Joan Osborne concluding the festival. More than a dozen of some of the best women musicians and female-fronted bands will perform beginning Friday morning at 11 o'clock and you'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org.
Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Michelle and Deggio Cello on Triad Arts Weekend. Who'd have thunk it? But there you have it. And things are just warming up, because after this short break, we're live in Studio A with world-renowned luthier and guitarist Wayne Henderson, Herb Key, and a big old bear next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Luthier Wayne Henderson is also one of today's leading guitarists, with three national tours with Masters of the Steel Guitar, a National Heritage Award, and Carnegie Hall and Prairie Home Companion concerts under his belt, just to name a few highlights. He's also been called the most masterful guitar maker in the country. From his studio in Rugby, Virginia, population 7 according to Wayne, where he grew up in the White Top Mountain area of Grayson County near the North Carolina border, Wayne's built instruments for artists including Eric Clapton and Wayne's friend, the late great Doc Watson. He's also repaired guitars used by Neil Young and Elvis Presley. Along the way, Wayne has met plenty of awesome performers, and he's bringing many of them together for his 19th annual Wayne C. Henderson Music Festival and Guitar Competition this Saturday, June 15th, in the beautiful Grayson Highlands State Park in Mouth of Wilson, Virginia. The festival runs from 10:30 to 7, and it'll feature the Quaby Sisters, Harrison Brothers, Crooked Road Ramblers, Cabin Fever, and, of course, Wayne Henderson and friends. Also during the festival, 20 outstanding guitar players from around the country will compete for a Henderson handcrafted guitar. This year's headliner will receive one too. She's superstar Roseanne Cash and her husband, John Leventhal. Wayne Henderson and his good friend, guitarist, bassist, vocalist Herb Key joined us live in Studio A.
Herb, let's do this old tune I learned from Doc Watson, one called Nothing to It.
Henderson there on guitar and Herb Key on guitar. That was Nothing to It, tuned by Doc Watson. I'm curious to know, from a picker's standpoint, what made that man so special?
You know, he was a legendary musician. Everybody knows that, and being able to play like he could, being blind, and he was certainly a gentleman. And you start bragging on him playing music and being what he was, he didn't want to hear that, you know. I think he considered his music just a good way to make a living. But he was certainly a gentleman and a good friend to all of us, and we miss him something awful. But yeah, he was a great character and a wonderful country gentleman. That's how I remember Doc.
You know. Yeah. It's great to hear that the first words out of your mouth basically talking about his humility, and that's something that folks say when they talk about Wayne Henderson. So it's something that must have rubbed off somehow.
Yeah, that tune came from I Don't Love Nobody. Wayne knows a story about that, how it got his name, Nothing to It.
Well, that's a pretty cool thing. You know, Doc, when he first started making those records back in the 60s, would take any kind of an old song like that or a popular tune, and he would turn it into a guitar instrumental. That's something that had never been done before. When Doc recorded that tune, it was actually an old-timey song called I Don't Love Nobody. It was on my favorite Doc record, one of the first ones I ever had.
Yeah.
And when he recorded that tune, the recording engineer asked him what the title of it was, you know, to write it down for the record. And Doc misunderstood him when he asked him that and thought he was bragging on his playing. And he said, oh, there ain't nothing to it. And so when that record came out, there was the title of that tune, Nothing to It. There Ain't Nothing to It, or something like that.
That's great.
And Doc always called that tune Nothing to It when he when he would play it, you know. And I think I got that story directly from Doc.
Speaking of storytelling, you got a tune for us that comes with a great story, The Preacher and the Bear. Where'd you first hear this one?
Well, you know, I actually learned the tune. I had heard it before. That thing has been recorded by dozens of artists back in the 20s and 30s and so on. But actually, I learned the version that I do from Doc.
For me, as an appreciator but not a picker, just to hear this man's name uttered for the first half of our interview just gives listeners an inkling as to what a great influence Doc Watson has been on so many people in great tradition.
Well, Herb, would you think about doing me that old song about the preacher and the bear? That's one I really like.
Well, yeah, that'd be a good one.
And
I always enjoy that. It's got a good message to it.
Oh, yeah, and it's an old-timey tune. I have this recorded on an old Edison cylinder thing that we listen to every once in a while. So it's got to be an old tune. Those old machines were about around 1900 or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, this one of my favorite Herb songs here, one he does about the preacher and the bear. Everybody knows you ain't supposed to be hunting on Sunday. And so if you listen to Herb's song here, you find out what might happen to you if you get out doing that.
Yeah.
Okay, you ready, Herb?
I think so. Now, preacher went out a-hunting, was on one Sunday morn. Was against his religion, but he carried his gun along. He shot himself 3 mighty fine quail, 1 little measly hare. Then on his way, returning home, he saw a great big grizzly bear. Now the bear marched out in the middle of the road, right up to the preacher, you see. Preacher got so excited that he climbed up a cinnamon tree. The bear sat down upon the ground, and the preacher climbed out on a limb. Then he cast his eye to the Lord in the sky, and his words he said to him, oh, Lord, didn't you deliver Daniel from a lion's den? Also deliver Jonah from the belly of the whale, and then 3 Hebrew children from the fiery furnace, so the good book do declare. Oh, Lord, if you can't help me, for goodness sakes, don't help that bear. Preacher was up in that tree, I think it was all night. He said, Mr. Bear, if you bother me, I'll give you an awful fight. Just about that time the limb let go and the preacher came tumbling down. You could see him a-getting his razor out before he hit the ground. Now he hit the ground a-cutting right and left, put up a very good fight. Then the bear grabbed the preacher and he squeezed him a little too tight. Preacher dropped the razor, and the bear held on with vim. Then he cast his eye to the Lord in the sky, and his words he said to him, oh, Lord, didn't you deliver Daniel from a lion's den? Also deliver Jonah from the belly of the whale, and then 3 Hebrew children from the fiery furnace, so the good book do declare. Oh, Lord, if you can't help me, please don't help that bear. They fought all the way to the river. It was a terrible fight. That bear just kept on hanging on, but the preacher wasn't doing all right.
He dragged that beast right down till the water was three times in and out. Then the bear got up and he limped away, and the preacher began to shout, "Oh Lord, and didn't you deliver Daniel from a lion's den? Also deliver Jonah from the belly of the whale, amen. And oh Lord, it may not look like much from way up there, but the hardest job I've ever done was baptizing that bear."
Thank you, Herb. Good job on that old team. One of my favorite ones right there.
I hope that helped that bear some, too.
Oh, I'm sure he's a better bear now.
I just wonder how you keep from cutting up yourself when you say the toughest thing he ever did was to baptize that bear. I mean, that's just it's hilarious. It's a great story, and the music paired with it is so perfect. What do you love most about playing this music, Wayne?
You know, I just love to do it, and it's been pretty much my life. Mm. My dad was an old-time fiddler, and the first thing I remember when I was just a young kid was seeing my dad and some of the neighbors come in and play old-time music. And it's just been a way of life for me, pretty much. And almost every day of my life, I have something to do with music or an instrument. And it seemed like I've never gotten tired of it. When I go in the shop or go somewhere to play music, it just seemed like as much fun as something I'd never done before.
And that's kind of the point of the festival, is encouraging that. And how's the tradition coming with young folks today?
I know in my lifetime, I'm getting up there. I'm getting to be a professional geezer now. I'm about 66 years old. And in my whole lifetime, I've never seen so many young people are playing music and so good. And every bit of the money we raise from that festival goes into a scholarship fund for young folks to learn how to play this music. Main reason I always sort of wanted that, because I remember how much fun I had trying to learn how to play music when I was a kid, and I've been at it ever since. You know, still working on it.
In addition to being a world-renowned picker, we've got one of the world-renowned luthiers sitting in our studio, and we're talking about working on Neil Young's guitar or working up an instrument for someone by the name of Eric Clapton, just for starters. Take us back. How did it begin for you?
I got started making guitars. I always made stuff when I was a kid. Was raised on a farm where it's pretty common. You have to make things you need to have. Yeah. You know, my dad and grandpa's all could make farm equipment. Stuff you need, but none of them ever made instruments. But when I got to playing music, I wanted one so bad. You know, I mean, I had a real cheap old guitar that was hard to play, and you know, I didn't have anything to work with. You know, no tools much, and I knew I had to bend wood, and you know, somehow. And the only thing I'd seen a piece of wood bend, there was a piece of veneer on my mom's dresser drawer bottom. I went in there one evening and slipped that thing out of there and laid it out in the creek that ran down behind the house all night. And sure enough, the next morning, that piece of wood had soaked loose and floated down the branch. And I got that veneer out and dried the board off and put it back in there. And Mom never knew anything about her dresser drawer bottom, you know.
Until now.
It wouldn't have mattered, you know, too much anyway, but I didn't know that. And I got that wood, and the only glue I could find is some my dad had stuck weather stripping on his truck door, which was just black sticky stuff, you know. And I worked my whole school vacation when I was about 12 or 13 years old or something, and to work on that guitar. And I was so proud of it. I had it laid out in a back building out there where nobody would see it, and you know, instrument makers were unheard of then, you know. And I was afraid my dad and all of them would think I'd lost my mind, you know, trying to make a guitar. And anyway, that thing, you know, even up in the mountains up there, when it gets August time, you know, we got some heat and humidity. And it set in on that veneer that still had spring left in it and that old rubber glue. Yeah, then I went out there to check on my guitar to work on it sometime, and it blossomed like a morning glory. It just totally came apart. And I didn't know what to do, and my dad could tell there was something wrong with me, you know, everything. And I finally told him I'd tried to make a guitar and it'd come apart. Mm-hmm. I almost had it done. And so he said, "Well, you know, the next day it's raining, but we can't work on the farm. I'll take you to see Albert Hash," because my dad was an old-time fiddler, and Albert had worked on his fiddle at some time or another, and he knew that he would know what kind of glue to use and stuff like that. Anyway, that went over and saw Albert, and he showed me a fiddle that he had made in 1953, and I could not believe my eyes, you know, that somebody's hands could make that beautiful an instrument. And, you know, it's carved and made out of beautiful curly maple wood, and that gave me the inspiration, because I knew Albert didn't have all that many tools either. So I worked another year on getting that guitar, and sure enough, it did stay. It's still together, and that is in early 1960s. And I still have that guitar, and that's the first one that I stamped a serial number in. I do tune and test every piece of wood I put in an instrument. Every piece of that guitar, before you even carve it or make it, will talk to you. You pick it up and tap on it and see how it rings, what tone it has, what pitch. Each component has important ring qualities to them. It might be something I don't know that anybody can explain. You test every piece of your instrument you're putting together. And I think occasionally one will go together that's just exceptional. And the reason old instruments, you know, tend to sound good, one that's in good shape, you know, that's been together for years. And I've heard all kinds of stories about the molecules in the wood, you know, how the vibration that runs back and forth through the grain of wood. And the more it does that, they say it lines those molecules up so they operate easier. You know, a nice old guitar or violin or something that's been around for years and gets played and vibrated, I think that's the reason it sounds better than a brand new one.
A lot of great players come into this festival. I'm sure they're no strangers to your instruments. And some of them may be new to our listeners. Now, one name that's not is Roseanne Cash.
I think we were real lucky to be able to get her to come. Roseanne's going to be playing over at Galax at the Music Center the Friday evening before, and I am too. They call it a kickoff to my festival. She's going to be over there, and I said, well, offer her a guitar and see if she will come. And of course, she sent back and said, of course she would. She would like to do that. And I think it's her husband, John, might have been more interested in the guitar, you know.
He plays, yeah.
He's a wonderful player and just, one of the good players you'll ever hear, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited for them to have a guitar, and also even more excited for them to come play the festival. That's, they're big people to play at a small festival, you know. And that's always the best place to see somebody like that, you know, without... You won't be, 200 yards away from the stage with binoculars trying to see them. You know, you can be up close.
My thanks to Wayne Henderson and Herb Key. The 19th annual Wayne C. Henderson Music Festival and Guitar Competition is this Saturday, June 15th, in the beautiful Grayson Highland State Park in Mouth of Wilson, Virginia. Tickets are available at the festival site, just $15, and children ages 12 and under are free when accompanied by a paying adult. Lots of kid-friendly activities as well. So far, the festival has raised nearly $100,000 in scholarships for young students, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer, indie rock artiste, today's guest host, and so much more, ladies and gentlemen, is Mr. Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin, and our intern is Kathleen Coker, who co-produced our Wayne Henderson feature today. Thanks, Kathleen. We'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. You'll find links to more information about all of the artists on today's program at wfdd.org. We leave you now with Wayne Henderson and Herb Key in a live performance of the Carter Family Medley. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.